Okay, so are there enough of them? We've seen a lot of this type of image, and mostly for this conference, we're interested in this frame where you can see that there's a change, you see that there's one of these exciting events, a type 1A supernova. But what I'm actually interested in are the progenitors. And so for me, this is the exciting image, not because it's exciting by itself, because it's exciting because we know that someplace in here, the progenitor was lurking. And one of the questions I'll be asking is, how can we find them? Now, I got involved in this in early in the game, and did some of the theoretical work in terms of trying to figure out how many of these there were, following up on the work of Ed and colleagues, and with colleagues, trying to understand some of the theoretical properties of these. And at some point, I realized that if we were going to take it further, we really had to find larger numbers of supersoft sources. And so I started working on programs so that we could observe them in other galaxies. And I'm going to talk about both types of work, because this sets the stage for that. Now, I don't need to define these again, because you've had supersoft sources defined so many times today. What I want to mention, though, is that we're looking at them, some of the work I'll be discussing, we're looking at them in external galaxies. We have something like 50 photons. If we're really rich in photons, we have a few hundred, right? That means that we are making a determination that this is a supersoft source based entirely on the X-ray spectrum. So I can't tell you, is it an accreting white dwarf or is it something else without, you know, except in nearby galaxies like M31, as Marina was discussing, well, you might be able to find an optical identification. So for me, supersoft source means anything that has these characteristics, and then if we think it's an accreting white dwarf, I'll call it a nuclear burning white dwarf. We think it's in a close binary, the things that you were calling supersoft sources, I'll call them close binary supersoft sources. And things in wider binaries, we'll call them wide binary supersoft sources. But it turns out that when we look at other galaxies, we see that there is a high luminosity and perhaps a higher KT extension of the class, that we find things that have somewhat more higher values of KT than supersoft sources, whereas supersoft sources in our galaxy and in the Magellanic Clouds tend to cut off their spectrum at 1 keV. There are others that we now call quasi-soft sources that cut off their spectra at 2 keV. We also find that some of the most luminous X-ray sources known are supersoft sources, 10 to the 41 ergs per second. These are very good candidates for intermediate mass black holes. But they're not the topic of our discussion today because they're not potential type 1A supernovae. So I'm going to skip over this because you've seen it so many times. One thing I'm going to talk about is just notice over here, this illustrates the controversy. You know, what happens to that extra material? Is it, you know, a red giant phase? Is it a wind? Is it sometimes one, sometimes the other? And because Professor Hachisu, who's an expert on this, is following me, that's, I'm sure, something that we'll learn more about. Okay, now there's one trivial question, or maybe it's not a trivial question, no question is trivial, but the answer is, you say, are type 1A progenitors supersoft sources? Well, I don't know of a model of type 1A progenitors, even double degenerates, where at some point you don't have a white dwarf that burns matter when nuclear burning goes on. And during that phase, it's potentially possible to see that object as a supersoft source. So virtually all progenitors, whatever they are, probably experience phases of nuclear burning and may possibly be seen as supersoft sources. Maybe they're obscured, but there's some place in the universe you could watch them from, maybe right from their surface, and see them as a supersoft source. What I want to ask is a different question, and that is, can we use the supersoft source behavior to probe and test the single degenerate models? Specifically, single degenerates must experience prolonged phases of mass increase, Presumably, nuclear burning is going on during that prolonged phase. During that phase is the potential type 1A supernova detectable as a supersoft X-ray source. So this is really the question in the epoch of interest to us during the genuine mass gain: are the progenitors detectable as supersoft sources? Well, first I just want to mention that one thing we did do in the early 1990s is to establish that galaxies like our own do host large populations of supersoft sources. For elliptical galaxies, they're so far away, Rosat couldn't see the sources, but based on diffuse soft emission, it was postulated that even they have populations of hundreds of supersoft X-ray sources. Now, what Saul Rappaport and I did is we seeded galaxies, including M31 in our galaxy, with supersoft sources. We drew the sources from the observed population and also from some theoretical work we had done. And we said that the few sources that we knew at that time were consistent with a population of roughly 1,000 in M31 and in our galaxy. We also said that, you know, we know, and I'll show again later on, that as the white dwarf mass increases, the luminosity and also the temperature of the sources increase. So if you ask yourself, what sources do you see when you look at external galaxies, you preferentially see the hottest, brightest sources. Those are the ones where the white dwarf mass is largest. And we thought that even Rosat was virtually complete, for white dwarfs, accreting white dwarfs that were nuclear burning, if they were above something like 1.25 solar masses. So those are the ones you're more likely to see. Okay, you already know something about various binary models. So I'm going to tell you about a theoretical population synthesis that we did, where we estimated mass transfer rates and found that some of the accreting white dwarfs did actually get to masses close to the Chandrasekhar mass. And the various parameters that we derived were verified in what I think is a more comprehensive population synthesis that Ed mentioned a little bit earlier by Lev Jungelson and his colleagues. But anyway, we were actually the first to sit down and say, okay, what does that tell us about type 1A supernovae? And honestly, we didn't know what to do about MDOT, so we made some assumptions. We said in the most optimistic case, if things that were accreting in the recurrent nova range could become type 1A supernovae, then the rate was actually larger than the rate of observed type 1A supernovae. But if we just required that M dot be in or above the steady burning range, the rate roughly matched the observed rate. And if we had it in the steady burning range all the time, never above it, then it fell well below the required rate. Now, that was just suggestive. We really didn't know what happened. To know what happens, you have to do some concrete evolutionary calculations, and that's what we went on to do with Lorne Nelson. Lorne actually, I'm not going to go through this derivation, this is from Lorne's presentation at the workshop a couple of weeks ago, so it's available there. And the key point is that to compute the mass loss rate of the donor, you have to model the donor's response to mass loss and also its response to the change in the Roche lobe. And Lorne did that by making connection with some Henier-like calculations that he was doing. And we also included the opportunity in this denominator for beta, the mass retention factor, to be less than 1, and for some of that matter to carry away angular momentum. The amount was parameterized by this parameter alpha. So we did the simulations, and we got evolutions something like this. and this is worth spending a minute or two on. In many cases, that denominator was so large that the system never had a chance to approach the stable burning region. The system could gain a modest amount of mass, perhaps, but nothing very dramatic would happen, nothing that could lead to a type 1a supernova. There were cases, though, in which the denominator was so small that the system would want to jump right up and, in fact, experience a common envelope. And that number of systems that were in that range was so large that it seemed as if we really could not come anywhere close to reproducing the rate of type 1a supernovae. We realized when we looked at it more carefully that this fell into the kind of regime that Stirl was talking about yesterday. There were some systems that you could save no matter what, and they, in our case, they were always boring because they never became type 1a supernovae. There were some systems you couldn't save no matter what. They were going to have common envelopes. But there were many systems that if in this region over here there could be some winds that would be ejected from the system carrying only modest angular momentum per unit mass with them, these systems could be saved, and those tended to be the ones that became supernovae. So our result is that you needed to have winds in order for there to be type 1a supernovae in this single degenerate model. We didn't say specifically whether the winds come from the white dwarf, whether they come from the donor, whether they come from the disk. But without them, the single degenerate model almost certainly does not produce the numbers of supernovae needed, at least not in these close binaries. We also said the winds are energetically possible. Now, since then, there's been a lot of progress, and this really leads up, I think, to Professor Hachisu's talk, because now we know that there can be winds from the white dwarf. We also know that radiation-driven winds are expected, and there are several different results for main sequence stars, close binary supersoft sources, wide binary supersoft sources, and they lead to the result that it is possible that nuclear burning white dwarfs in the single degenerate model are a significant component of type 1a progenitors. But they do not prove that this model works, but they do show that it is possible. So that's where we're looking at external galaxies come in. Here we show as a function of the white dwarf mass, we show the temperature, log of the temperature, and the white dwarf mass plotted against it, and you see that the higher the white dwarf mass, and we've let these white dwarfs accrete, the higher the temperature. In this image, this corresponds to white dwarfs near the Chandrasekhar mass, and each group is a tenth of a solar mass less massive. Again, the more massive the white dwarf, the more luminous the system, the harder it is to hide. So how many accreting systems should there be if the single degenerate model is everything? Well, in order to accrete 4/10 of a solar mass, if you're accreting with beta times m dot, that's m dot onto the white dwarf, in the range of 4 × 10⁻⁷ solar masses per year, it will take you 10⁶ years to accumulate 0.4 solar masses. And if you want to reproduce the observed supernova rate, that tells you that there have to be an awful lot of these systems. Now you can bring this down by saying perhaps we do this at a higher accretion rate, right? For a large part of the evolution, perhaps beta is close to 1. You can bring it down by maybe an order of magnitude, but not much more than that. So what do we see? Well, what this image is meant to show you is that Chandra would be able to see those sources which have white dwarf masses, in this case of 1.3, and in this case of 1.1 solar masses, that would detect enough counts to see in M31 all of those potential progenitors of type 1a supernovae, and similarly for M101. As you go down to lower white dwarf mass, you begin to lose systems if the absorption is too high, but for 10 to the 21, you're probably complete even in N31. So in other words, Chandra does what we think ROSAT was close to doing, which is it can detect radiation from those white dwarfs that are close to the Chandrasekhar mass if they are accreting and burning material. Now, how much of the galaxies do we see? M31 is a little difficult, although Marina has bravely forged ahead with it. But here we take a look at M101, and we see that this is one Chandra chip, and it gets most of the galaxy, and we have data from the other chips as well. So geometrically, we can catch everything. What do we find? What are the observed numbers? This is the punchline. Well, in M101, we find 42 supersoft sources, 21 quasi-soft sources, and 65 other X-ray sources. This was in a 100 kilosecond exposure. There's now a lot more data available. But the results are not going to change very much. We're certainly not going to get up to 1,000. No way. And the ones that are there are not all nuclear burning white dwarfs. There's some interesting features of this graph, and perhaps this is something that you could look at when these go online or we can discuss later. You see that in the early type galaxies, these are ellipticals, the fraction of all sources that are supersoft sources goes down tremendously, although not necessarily the fraction that are quasi-soft. What does that mean? I'm not sure, but it's something that's worth paying attention to. So finally, I'd like to understand the implications of this. So are there enough supersoft sources? The answer is no, and it's no by at least an order of magnitude, maybe two. So Chandra has already falsified the hypothesis that accreting nuclear burning white dwarfs that reach the Chandrasekhar mass are the principal progenitors, and that they are detected as supersoft sources during the epoch of maximum mass gain. That is ruled out. So does that falsify the single degenerate Chandrasekhar mass model? It could, and we should take that seriously. But it doesn't necessarily, because, how about a sub-Chandrasekhar model? Well, as you got a hint from those graphs, we're on the verge of being able to rule that out, too, so I don't think that's the ultimate answer. However, note that this result is consistent with obscuration by winds, and the winds are associated with binary models. They're needed. So on the one hand, we can say, well, in 1995 in Spain, we said you need winds if you're going to make this work. And now we see that the systems, if they exist at all, must be obscured. Perhaps that works, but it's premature to say that that is the case. Could photospheric effects of the type we were just discussing come into play? That's a possibility. Our input assumptions could be incorrect. Maybe you can accrete and keep the matter at lower accretion rates. That would make the systems less luminous. And then we shouldn't be able to see them. So are there other tests of these models? Well, yes. If we're predicting winds in the binary evolution models, we can do a much better job of predicting them. And that's something that I take as a priority. And then we can look at the effects of these winds on their surroundings. We can also check to see if these highly ionizing sources do, in fact, ionize the region around them. Cal-83 is the only one of the known supersoft sources to have a nebula. This is a 10 parsec nebula around Cal-83 in the Magellanic Clouds. Why don't we see these in other systems? We don't really know, but it may be consistent with this obscuration during significant portions of the evolution. We can predict the post-explosion signatures, and I refer you to work by Carlis for that. And eventually, we may all be challenged by the lack of hydrogen in the post-explosion spectra. I'm not yet quite as pessimistic as Sumner was this morning, but we have to take this very seriously. There is a level at which these models could be ruled out. So, Type 1a supernovae occur far away, and a lot of people in this room look for them. But progenitors occur nearby. We predict 10 to 30 with white dwarf masses greater than a solar mass within 1 kiloparsec if the single degenerate model dominates. Where are these? Well, maybe RSO is one of them, right? Right. But there are more than that, and they all have high luminosities if they are undergoing steady nuclear burning. That is, if this model is correct, that energy is doing something. We should see distinctive spectra. We don't know yet exactly what waveband they come out in, but they have to come out someplace. We can discuss that. There may be ionization or wind signatures. This is my very simplified version of Lev's population synthesis. Everything starts as a binary. It does one thing or it does something else. The point is there are lots of opportunities for cross-checks as we find binaries, whether they're CVs, symbiotics, or double degenerates. And here is my summary. We should search for the progenitors nearby. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I know we'll have already many hands on that one.
Could it be that the duty cycle is just really small so that they're only burning for like 5% of the time or something like that?
Well, that's an interesting hypothesis. If you make the duty cycle of nuclear burning short, then to produce the observed rate, you need more of them. And so what you would see is, instead of saying that there are 3,000 that are, you know, maybe the same ones that are on all, that are burning all the time, now there could be 10 times as many burning only a tenth of the time. And so you're less likely to look up and see the same one again and again, but at any given time, you'd still have this large galactic population. So what you need is you need for the burning to be going on, but the duty cycle of detectability to be short, either due to photospheric effects or obscuration of some type.
Two questions. What was the 1A rate that you were trying to match in each of these galaxies specifically? Was it matched to the star formation rate or the Hubble type or whatever?
I just used, actually, in the case that I showed you, the case where I showed a number, we were using the old number of 0.3 per century per 10 to the 10 in LB.
For any galaxy?
Well.
So your crisis could actually get worse, say, for things like M101 or something?
Oh, absolutely. I would view the rate that we computed and under those rough assumptions as a kind of an upper limit. Today, though, we know that there are other channels for these, for binaries that, for example, the wide binary channel, which perhaps Professor Hachisawa will also discuss, is another way to do it. And what Lorne and I found is that if we were allowed to just play with the mass retention and angular momentum loss, we could do anything. But nature presumably doesn't allow us to just do anything at all that we want. Therefore, I think one of the pioneering, you know, one of the forefront fields has to be trying to understand as a function of different input parameters which sets of physical inputs can produce the type 1 and supernova rate, looking at all the binary model, and then carefully investigating whether those are physically realistic or not. I would view at all of these predictions as very crude.
And just a follow-up question, to follow up on Alan's talk earlier, do you have a picture of the distribution of the SSSs in the galaxies?
Oh, you know, in the talk I gave for the workshop I did, I have some. I was going to put them on here, but since it wasn't the main point and we only had 20 minutes, I didn't. But I have lots of images that I can show you, and perhaps I'll add them to this talk. A very interesting thing about them, which I didn't say, is that they, in spiral galaxies, the super soft sources tend to follow the spiral lines, which is a surprise to me.
How certain are you that they really should be look like super soft sources? If you take Euscorpii, for example, I mean, which is a system which I think is an excellent type 1A candidate, which is close to the Chandrasekhar mass, it doesn't really look like a classical supersoft source. Only during the outburst does it have supersoft features.
Well, that's exactly my point. I think we can say that they shouldn't, that there are two ways of looking at it. One is purely theoretical. The theoretical calculations will produce a population of super soft sources. And we now know enough about external galaxies that we could repeat the work that Saul and I did and, you know, feed these galaxies with sources and see if the theory matches the observations. My baseline impression is that if we lose all of the massive white dwarfs from those calculations because of common envelope considerations, then we will not really reproduce the observations. However, the calculations that have been done that show that we need winds tell us that most of these systems should not look like supersoft sources most of the time. They should be obscured by winds. External absorption is not enough. You can put them in galaxies and ask yourself, how much does the NH along the line of sight hurt you? And it does hurt, but it hurts mostly the lower luminosity, lower temperature sources, which are almost invisible to us when they're in other galaxies. When you take these really bright ones, really hot ones, we should be able to see them if they're there. I think we know now that they're not there in the numbers that we would need for them to be progenitors. And maybe that's okay, because my other point was that the theory predicts that we shouldn't see them looking that way. But I view the predictions of theory as still in a rather preliminary stage, because a lot of fundamental physics is missing from them.
Any other questions? Actually, then I'll ask one. You mentioned you needed winds, and then winds could provide the obscuration, which I know very well from symbiotics, because many of these are not observed in the X-rays, even though we think most of them do have some nuclear burning. Have you compared the numbers, like what rate of mass loss you'd need, and would that obscure your supersoft sources?
I've done so. I didn't present it here because I didn't have anything that I was ready to present. But yes, I mean, if you take a look at the amount of winds that you would expect in the context of the binary evolution models, they're certainly enough to obscure the system so that you wouldn't see it. Now, a lot depends on the state of that. A lot depends on what the spatial distribution turns out to be. What I think is a great element of it is that if you can compute that from first principles, you can give that to the supernova people and say, okay, this is the environment into which the supernova expands and into which the radiation is sent. And so will the result look like the post-explosion signature or the supernova remnant signature? So I think we're at the level where we need those calculations.
Exactly the problem we're running into with symbiotics.
Okay.
Thank you very much.